But you've heard this whole thing with William Shatner and how he's created this Star Trek versus Star Wars.
First of all, Star Wars is derivative of Star Trek. By, what, 10, 15, 20 years, something, whatever it was. Derivative.
They're not in the same league. I mean, they have the word star in the title.
True.
And there's a space travel, right? Where do they go to? I don't really... Klingon?
Larnar.
It just sounds like a laundry detergent.
Yeah, Star Trek had relationships and conflict among the relationships and stories that involved humanity and philosophical questions, which were dramatized at their best. Star Wars was special effects. Was ILM at its best.
They've been syndicated. And to be syndicated is actually physically painful.
God knows what those actors look like in reality with all those special effects. I mean, there's no telling what ILM did for those faces and those hairdos. They may have walked around with nothing on, and they got clothed by and made up by ILM. We don't know. We don't know what they were like.
Now he's saying we're all naked in the show because they can draw bathing suits. Really? I don't think so. I had the metal bikini. By the way, Bill has borrowed it.
Sundance Film Festival, more like Sundance Film Sextical. Wow. In honor of Sundance, what is your favorite sex scene from a movie this year?
Well, I have to say, the funniest sex scene was a premature ejaculation from Lovelace, and the grossest sex scene was Juno Temple doing it with a hairy fat guy in Afternoon Delight. But I think the sexiest sex scene was when Daniel Radcliffe takes up the butt and Kill Your Darlings.
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the scene of loss of virginity in The Spectacular Now, which is not especially sexy, but is very tender and well shot.
And I'm Matt Patches, and I am going to go with a kind of a sex scene, but in Don John's Addiction, Scarlett Johansson gets Joseph Gordon-Levitt to come in the middle of her hallway by just recommending he take night classes.
I would like to see that.
Yeah. There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
It's a podcast.
Hello, welcome to Operation Kino for the week of Friday, January 25th, 2013. This week, I don't even know what's coming out. I have been at the Sundance Film Festival
Gretel,
for a week.
Movie 43.
And Parker. None of those movies we have seen.
Are they screening them for critics, I think.
And I think they're all potential Oscar nominees.
Yes, that's true. The Oscar buzz has begun early this year. I'm here with Matt Patches. We are both in Utah, and we are here in Utah for the Sundance Film Festival.
True.
And we are here with our special guest, Brian Moylan, who works at Hollywood.com along with Matt Patches.
Hi.
Thank you for sitting on this couch.
It's my pleasure to be on our couch in our wonderful condo apartment here.
I know, our home away from home.
Yes.
So we're going to be talking about Sundance. We're going to kind of do similar to what we did last year, wrap up what we've seen, what we've liked, the trends. Sex is going to come into play. Spoiler alert. That's the inspiration for the lightning round. But before that, we're going to hear from Dave, who has been home watching Fringe. And is going to talk about it since he knows a lot of things about
reacting
Fringe.
To the finale.
Yeah. There's been a lot happening in the world since we've been here. That Beyonce.
Who knows?
Yeah, Beyonce. Everyone's talking about Beyonce.
Michelle Obama has bangs.
I know.
Who knew?
Huge news. So we're going to throw to Dave, and then after you hear from him, you'll hear from us again to talk about Sundance.
Hi guys, this is Dave. We'll be getting back to Katie and Sundance and Patches and special guest. Pretty soon. First off, I'm going to have an experiment where I pull another Dave from the parallel dimension and have him ask me some questions about Fringe. But first up, I wanted to do our Op Kino throwback. This week's look back episode, we've been doing one a week, counting up to Op Kino episode 100, is Operation Kino number 57, which is Nostalgia for American Reunion, an Op Kino indie interview with Bria Grant. Bria Grant's film, Best Friends Forever, which we discussed on that episode, premiered at Slamdance this week. So congratulations to everybody. That was our first Op Kino indie. I think it's a really great interview about doing an indie film and how she did it with like an all-female cast. While you're going to get Operation Kino number 57, you're on iTunes, so you should subscribe to us or leave us a review because we read them, and more importantly, they help other people find us on iTunes. which we'd really like, because we're going to try to find as many people so we're not just talking to the people that see the same movies every week. You see the thing I'm trying to build up to here? I'm trying to have some continuity here leading up to Opkino number 100, what I'm calling the full quell, which we are on the precipice of these days. But first, this week, not this week, I'm sorry, it's been a while. Last week, Fringe went off the air. It's been a while since I've talked to you about Fringe, but I sort of got the feeling that not any more of you are watching it than were previously. So I'm going to try to give sort of like a general pitch for why you should check out the series, because the Science Channel, which is a division of Discovery Channel, is airing Fringe on Fridays. They're about up to, I believe, they've just begun season 3. I think Hulu Plus also has some access to some Fringe, and there's always DVDs. And there's ways to see Fringe if you decide you want to jump on the Fringe plane. So the way I want to do this, I guess, is bring in somebody that hasn't seen all five seasons of Fringe, and have them ask some questions. And that person is going to be my parallel universe counterpart, Dave. I could only assume he spells his name with a 6 or an 8.
What?
Maybe a 4 in place of the A.
What is that? Is that like something you do here? You spell numbers and letters and shit?
Yeah, that's a thing I do.
You?
I'm going to skip over.
Okay, then you seem to be skipping a lot.
Yeah.
In another universe, it's kind of jarring.
Yeah, I don't think we should really worry about the actual physics of what's happening, because it sort of has to do with the show.
I mean, it might make good radio.
It's from J.J. Abrams, the guy made Lost.
What? What are these things you're saying?
Yeah, well, you kind of dodged a bullet there. All right, so Fringe initially looked like J.J. Abrams does The X-Files, which I could see why that would turn people off, because it's sort of episodic monster of the week. It has Olivia, played by Anna Torv, and Peter, played by Joshua Jackson, and Walter, played by John Noble, sort of making this unlikely trio. And they're searching down sort of this red herring plot line of Olivia's lover / betrayer guy. And he's talking about the pattern.
Oh, okay. So there's three people and they're working together to solve mysteries, I guess. Some sort of mathematical mysteries.
Okay, I realize none of that made sense. Season 1 of Fringe is still trying to find its footing, but it's establishing the base relationships between all the characters.
Okay.
Peter has to engage with his father, Walter, who's been locked up in a mental institution for most of Peter's life, and Peter doesn't really have very fond memories of him. But Walter might be the Walter's research that he used to do with his old partner, William Bell, who's played by Leonard Nimoy later on in the series. They did a lot of Fringe science work, which helps them solve these cases that they call the pattern. Anyway, it turns out that the pattern is a group of people trying to resurrect a man called David Robert Jones, who is played by, this is so much easier when
Jared Harris.
Oh, thank you. Yes. So David Robert Jones is trying to cross over into this other universe, and we learn that Olivia had been experimented on previously by Walter in this drug called Cortexafan. And that's sort of season 1. It stumbles a little bit, but it's more about establishing these three characters in their way around each other and the existence of another universe, because season 2, it turns out the parallel universe is much more tied to our, you know, core characters, with Peter is actually a child from the other universe. That's a little bit of a spoiler, but it comes, you know, late in season 2. But by the time that becomes it becomes like a cornerstone plot moment Fringe. Season 3 takes place in between two split universes, as they sort of go to war with each other over the fact that moving Peter as a child from one universe to another caused the parallel universe to collapse. Okay, it's okay. I'm almost done with the sci-fi stuff. Season 4 happens where Peter gets erased so he could heal the two universes, and season 5 continues after these sort of all sentient, all-knowing beings named the Observers come and take over Earth. And it turns out that Peter and Olivia are also alive then, and so is Walter, and they have to sort of save all of Earth by jumping through time.
That sounds so complex and so much plot.
The plot is good because it's a sci-fi show, but the thing that it's really important about Fringe is how it treats its characters.
So that might have sounded stupider because it was condensed.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter if you're seeing other versions of these characters because you're still seeing something that you could realize as your Olivia or your Peter that you grew to know in the first season. So it sort of builds this grand operatic thing by spinning off.
Okay, and that's the appeal of it?
Yeah. I would say the reason we're talking about it now is the finale wrapped up, and it was actually pretty satisfying in terms of, like, comparing it to something like Lost, which also had a lot of mythology and a lot of character to wrap up. I think it did a much better job, because at this point, we'd already dumped off a whole bunch of mythology cliffhangers. You know, the universes had been merged, we figured out where Peter was from, you know, we were in the future. So, this one, it didn't really... The plot, although interesting and involving the fate of the world, wasn't really at the crux of it, and so you didn't have this momentous, you know, Jack's gonna fight the smoke monster moment, also with the, you know, light church heaven that I'm talking about Lost.
Okay,
right,
yeah.
Never mind. Other universe.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Your universe seems weird.
Didn't see Lost.
Anyway, but what I really liked about Fringe is it happened to actually coalesce around the characters, and it didn't default to love as the answer like Lost did. It sort of did, but it did that between each different character relationship. So by having a resolution between all the character relationships, it sort of built to a grand revolution. There wasn't a grand theory of everything, even though I think that it sort of worked so that all the dimensions and seasons got erased, so only the fourth season really happened.
I think you front-loaded this conversation in a way that is going to make newbies not want to see it.
I don't know. I think that I'm speaking to sci-fi fans. If you know what I'm talking about, and you obviously do because you're me from another dimension, then you probably like Fringe.
Well, I mean, we don't have Fringe.
Yeah, I wish you could see it on the Science Channel, you know, Fridays. But I'm going to have to send you back to your dimension now.
I mean, you don't have to. There's, like, some
better fuck off, Other Dave.
Bye.
All right. In lieu of a music break before I toss you to Park City, Utah with Patches and Katie and special guest, here is a user edit of episode 96 Patches Matches Trivia. Twitter user and Opkino super listener Ink as Rain has cut together all of our thinking sounds to form Opkino Orgy.
All right, Katie, ready?
Okay. Ooh.
No peeking.
Uh huh.
Oh yeah.
Ooh.
Movies.
Oh.
Movies.
David.
This hurts. Movies.
Oh.
No, you're screwed. You're screwed.
It's.
My God, Dave.
Oh, God, Patches!
Oh, Dave, you're so close.
No!
I'm sorry.
Oh.
David!
Yeah, movies.
Oh.
Oh, come on!
Come on!
Oh, come on!
You say come on, but Dave? We did.
All right.
Oh boy. Oh.
Oh. Wow. That's hard.
Ooh.
Fuck. Okay.
No, you have to put one more in.
Ooh. Movies.
Oh. Oogie Loves.
Yes.
Boom.
Good job, everyone.
Yeah.
But we gotta wrap this up.
Oh, God damn it. Oh, come on. Why am I always forgetting penises?
Back to Utah, where the snow is on the ground, And we've all seen more movies.
Sort of. It's not really that.
That's true. It's been raining today, which is really lame. But we've all seen a ton of movies. I think I've done about 25 at this point. I don't know about you two.
I haven't been counting. I'm kind of lost. I'm dizzy.
Yeah, I'm going to count at the end because I don't really even want to know at this point how many I've seen.
It's a little horrifying. But at this point, you can kind of start seeing trends in movies. There's been, we've all seen a lot of stuff. We've all heard what other people are talking about. And Brian, you have come up with some ideas of what some of the major trends of the festival have been this year.
Well, I think that since we'll talk about real trends first, but I think that there's definitely been a strain of like magical realism and everything where there's, you see these things where, you know, reality is a bit off kilter. Like there was a lot of that in Stoker. There was a lot of that in the abominable Necessary Death of Charlie Countryman where he
Shia
sees,
LaBeouf.
Oh, where he sees fairies. And I think we're seeing, with the movie you guys haven't seen yet, Escape from Tomorrow, that is like so. I don't know that it's even magical realism. I don't think there's any realism in it.
It's very magical because it takes place at Disney World.
Yeah,
in the Magic Kingdom.
Do you want Escape from Tomorrow is one of the ones that's been most buzzed about because everyone thinks they're not going to be able to see it ever. Can you briefly explain what the deal with that is?
It's a movie that they shot kind of guerrilla style in Disney World and Disneyland. And so it's full of like the Disney princesses and all the characters and rides and Cinderella's castle and all that stuff. And it's about a guy who is at Disneyland with his family, and he finds out he loses his job, and you think it's going to be like a sad kind of thing about him at Disney World dealing with it, and it ends up becoming this super bonkers, surreal thing where it's in his imagination, and he gets kidnapped, and he has sex with a witch, and
We've all been there.
Yeah,
well,
it's
every
just,
vacation ends that way.
It gets so, so crazy, but I mean, it's really good. It's shot in black and white. It's like nothing anyone's ever seen before, and
wow.
I really hope that it gets released because it's
well,
totally worth it.
I've heard that in Q&As, the director said if there's for some reason lawyers step in and they're not able to put it out, that they'll probably just leak it on BitTorrent. Or something like that. I think this film for him is a calling card.
Yes.
Now. Someone's going to let him make more movies because this was so crazy and he is obviously has a vision for this sort of thing and he will for his next film. So in the end, even if it doesn't come out in an official way, it's still a huge success for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
I absolutely agree.
That's one of the fun movies that comes at a festival that nobody's expecting anything about. And then one person sees it and it's like, holy shit, you guys, you have to see this. So we're going to the last screening that we possibly can tonight and we'll be the last ones on the train. All right. More trends, Brian?
So the trend that's driving me the most crazy is bad haircuts. There have been so many people with lousy haircuts. Evan Rachel Wood had the world's worst haircut. I mean, it was possibly
in the Necessary Death of Charlie Countryman.
It was and it
for
was
a movie you hate. That is like
it was
you're
really
stuck on
stuck
it.
In your craw.
I know, and it was probably the worst thing about the worst movie I've seen. So that just shows you how bad her haircut was. And then Ellen Page has the worst haircut ever on a lesbian in Touchy Feely, and to have the worst haircut of any lesbian is really hard.
Well,
sure,
I feel like she bounces back in the East.
In the East. She does have good
hair
in the East.
She had good hair in the East?
Yeah.
I mean, for
no
someone
bangs.
Who, like, bathes in a lake. Yes.
And then there was a really bad haircut on Robin Wright Penn. Robin Wright, quotation marks, Penn, who had this really, another, like, just awful blonde
in
haircut.
Two Mothers.
Yeah.
Which is another movie about people having sex.
Yeah, another weird sex movie. And then another one of my favorite trends is snake bites.
Oh yeah.
We've seen a lot of snake there was actual snake bites in both Toy's House and in Mud, and then there was talk about snakes in both Prince Avalanche
True.
And in Big Sur.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's a lot of snakes
hyper
happening.
Specific.
You really
have
your ear to the ground.
There's also two Jane Lynch as a psychiatrist movies.
Oh, really? I've only seen one
of
them.
Which?
Afternoon Delight.
And ACOD.
Oh.
And I think that she's hilarious to both of them.
Do you want Jane Lynch to be your psychiatrist now?
I don't know about that. She's not a very adept psychiatrist in either of them.
That's true.
So.
She also plays psychiatrist on 2.5 Men, which many of you may
Did
not
she really?
Realize.
One of Matt Patch's favorites.
Wait, 2.5 Men into Sundance. No one expected that.
Katie, what about you? What have you seen or the trends? Or
well, I mean, the obvious trend that I think,
working?
And not just me, I mean, Brian's got the hyper-specific. He's got the unique spin on the trends. But the one that everyone's been talking about is sex, which is why we had that for our lightning round. There have been a ton of movies about porn, a ton of movies about sexual relationships, movies about people having sex with people they shouldn't be, movie about people's sex lives being bad and then getting good. There's been, like, James Franco's had, like, 4 movies about sex.
Yeah.
I think he directed 2 movies about sex, including one with a very unsimulated graphic sex scene in it, which I think is the only unsimulated sex I've seen at Sundance. I don't know if you've...
There is unsimulated sex in the Kink documentary,
oh, okay.
which he produced.
Which it also...
Yeah, and then in Interior Leather Bar, which he also produced, and he's in Lovelace.
And he's in Lovelace playing Hugh Hefner.
Right, yeah. So
James Franco is half responsible for this entire trend.
Well, I think that there's a difference between the porn trend and the sex trend. Like, I think there's always a lot of sex in Sundance, but I think that it's, like, hyper-specifically focused on, like, the porn and sex trade industry this mm-hmm. time, where you have Lovelace, you have... The Look of Love, which
Steve
is about
Coogan,
porn.
Yeah, the British guy who founded a porn empire.
Yeah, and you have Kink, which is a documentary about Kink.com, which is a porn website. And, you know, and then you have hooker movies like Afternoon Delight and Concussion. So,
this is going to be like the greatest festival for Mr. Skin.
Oh, my God.
There's been a lot of naked famous people.
I've seen so many boobs and vaginas.
Do you know Temple's Mr. Skin page is going to light up when all
I'm sure it's already lit up. Jamie Temple gets naked a lot.
Yeah, she wasn't naked in Lovelace, only in Afternoon Delight.
Afternoon Delight, yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you feel like there's connective tissue between all the sex and maybe the porn stuff that we've seen in these movies? Like, why is this emerging as a trend? What are people obsessed with? I find it unique that Joseph Gordon-Levitt decided to do Don John's Addiction about pornography. Like,
yeah.
Why...
Right.
From that movie, like, what sense am I getting about his interest in that topic? Or what people seem to be gravitating towards that makes... porn and sex a target for indie.
Well, I think that at ACOD last night, which is about, it's a divorce comedy, and I'm getting to sex, don't worry. But, so he, the director was talking about how, you know, we've lived with divorce for so long, like now we can finally like talk about it and joke about it in an adult way. And I think that porn is the same way, where it's like, it's become so saturated in our culture and such a part of everyday life that it's kind of no longer as titillating as it once was. And I think that we can finally start to look at it in mature ways about what it is and what it does to us, rather than just being like, oh my God, porn, this is about porn. Mm. And so I think that's kind of what we're seeing now, is like people engaging with it in a way other than as masturbation material.
Well, and what Don John's Addiction does, which I think is really noble, even though it doesn't pull it off that well, is talk about how people are warped by the porn that they watch. With the unlimited access to porn that the internet gives you, your perspective on relationships gets totally screwed up, which is really what Don John's Addiction about, and I think is really valuable. And it's something that like almost Lovelace kind of gets into, about this woman who's in the porn industry but then is having this horrible relationship back at home. So there's something about like the... like, not just looking at porn as, like, a bad thing, but, like, being able to dig into it and actually see the impact it has on us without saying, like, porn is a bad thing
right.
for you.
I guess Sundance is probably the only, and independent film in general, is the only place that these filmmakers and actors can release their feelings
oh my God.
About sex, because you're not going to do it in a big Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
Right. Although, then you see something like Don John's and some of the other movies get big payouts, like $10 million, $9 million buys,
yeah.
and huge releases over the summer. It's like... why, I guess Hollywood's afraid to make these movies, even though they want to make these movies.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of this stuff is kind of your typical, like, some major star comes, I guess, in a Sundance movie and, like, shows off their boobs or, you know, naked ass, and that's their indie thing, like Amanda Seyfried and Lovelace and Daniel Radcliffe, who's a, you're a big fan of his,
yes.
His work in the bedroom.
Yeah,
and the work in general in that movie.
Oh yeah,
that's
true.
Outside
the
yeah,
sex.
That's true.
Yeah, and I think that I think his sex was really good, but I saw the movie with my boyfriend, and I was joking that he needs to work on his dick in the butt face. Like there's a very specific face that everyone makes, especially the first time you're doing it, and he isn't quite down. So I can probably say,
as someone who is not gay, I bought it.
Right,
as the first time reaction.
I did as well, but I know he didn't go method for this part. That's all I'm going to say.
Fair enough. Rumors to rest with that one.
Exactly.
Yeah, we got the official scoop on that. you go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask you something. You know, I feel like the obvious point in this conversation is, what's the best thing you saw at Sundance? And everyone's going to have top fives and that sort of thing. But I want to ask you what movie maybe affected you the most or seemed to like... hit you the hardest, because I feel when we see movies at Sundance, we're just like grinding away, and obviously we've been doing this for a while. We were talking off podcast about like being over, you know, we're overdosing on movies at some point, but I feel like the best ones aren't necessarily the ones that hit us the hardest throughout this kind of thing. So what movies hit you?
I was really affected by Before Midnight, which it surprised me in a way because I only watched the first two movies a week ago and I wasn't that invested in it, but something about where that movie caught them in their lives. You know, it's the return of Celine and Jesse 9 years later. I don't want to talk too much about what happens in it, but it felt really emotional. I think I'm far away from home. I'm far away from my boyfriend and my life. And then you see these movies about people's intimate relationships and you're like, oh, I'm alone in the mountains. This is terrible. But I was just so happy watching that. And it's also such a great movie that I got kind of that like visceral, I'm watching a great movie sense, which also happened a little bit in The Spectacular Now and has kind of similar emotions about relationships. And I mean, that movie really takes you on like a whole bunch of different emotions. There were people sobbing in the theater.
Emotions stacked on top of emotions.
Indeed.
In that movie.
It does it really, really well, too. And Before Midnight is, too. It's very funny, and then it gets pretty sad and intense and goes back and forth. And it's always amazing when you can see these movies made for however little money, kind of, you know, or in the case of Before Midnight, like, they go and made it before they told anybody about it. And they're perfect. They're just like these little gems of things. I think that's what you come to Sundance for, really. Brian?
I saw Stoker, which is the Chan-wook Park movie, right before I saw Escape from Tomorrow. And they're both, like, so weird and off-kilter. And, like, I was really affected by Stoker, and I loved it, because, like, everything in the movie, it looks like real life, but it's all, like, slightly off. And, like, the one example I give is that at the end, the credits go from the top of the screen to the bottom.
You know
what I mean? And you just think it looks normal.
You mean the
and
bottom
it's, like,
of the screen, Yeah.
And, you know, everything looks normal, but it's all, like, messed up, so it looks crazy. And so I saw that, and then saw Escape from Tomorrow, which was so weird, and I left the theater, and I felt like I was on drugs. Like, I thought I was hallucinating. It was so weird.
It's interesting you bring up Stoker, because I know that movie, when we left the theater, it didn't seem like people were really responding to it the way the three of us were. There were a lot of negative reviews, mostly calling the movie kind of slight, that the characters weren't really fleshed out, that nothing really mattered, and it was all style over substance. But I'm with you. That movie hit me really hard. And just like, I keep making this comparison, and maybe it's not apt, but I think it's like The Master in that The Master for me is a movie about performance. It's about using cinema to its fullest potential and kind of just hitting you with that and conceiving scenes that will maximize that energy. And for me, Stoker takes a really simple kind of Hitchcockian thriller angle and just lays it all out there, slathers it in cinema. That movie, like, kicked my ass.
I said it was like a Miyazaki movie with real people. And that it's like kind of like this allegory fairy tale, and it's all like weird and doesn't all quite make sense, but I find it to be like, I respond to it viscerally in like the same way.
And it was interesting about us all, the three of us sat in Stoker together and we got out kind of like really excited about it, and then you look on Twitter, this is a movie that nobody's seen, nobody knows if it's going to be any good, so your reaction is really not influenced by what you know of anyone else. And then we get out and we see that everyone else hated it. And there were these horrible negative reactions on Twitter.
I know. I couldn't believe it.
I know.
We immediately had to drink wine.
Yep.
Because we were so sad.
Yeah.
But I've talked to a lot of people since then who have also really enjoyed it.
Yeah, there are people coming out of the woodwork. But that's like that unique festival experience of where you go into a movie having no idea what other people think. And then it turns out you could be totally different from everyone else. Like, you thought you were seeing a totally different movie.
And as much as I love movie people, like, that's all you can talk to about these movies. It's like, I kind of want to talk to some of my quote-unquote real friends about, you know, like...
What the hell is that?
Yeah. Well, it's just people who aren't as knowledgeable and invested in movies and, like, how they will react to some of these things.
Well, I was thinking about that when I saw Upstream Color, which is kind of the most anticipated movie movie. We went to the premiere on Monday. We're like, it's going to be crazy. Everyone's so excited about this. And it wasn't that big because it doesn't have any stars in it. I mean, even at Sundance, the like stuff like that that's not as mainstream is not going to get as much attention. And that movie's had an emotional impact on a lot of people, but neither... You haven't seen it, right, Brian?
I've not seen it. It's totally not my...
Yeah, it's not really my thing either.
It's a poem.
Yeah, I love
poems.
Poems.
You're the one who keeps calling it Malikian.
Well, no, okay. I called it that once, you know. And I'm sorry, when like, the Shane Carruth, who is also the lead actor in the film, there's a shot of him, like, passing his hand along a rack of CDs. That's exactly the same thing as, like, passing your hand through wheat in Tree of Life. I'm sorry, it's exactly the same. But for me, I know that our visceral reaction leaving Upstream Color was kind of like, whoa, what the hell did we just watch? I don't know if there's anything there. It's kind of this mucky, expansive, ambitious,
project, but I don't know if there's anything really there. And for me, thinking about it afterward has been the most gratifying part about Upstream mm-hmm. Color. It's a really dense, thoroughly constructed movie that also uses kind of that flowy imagery and you know, putting a lot into the subtext as opposed to just overtly, you know, like Shane Carruth's Primer. This isn't... That's a tightly constructed movie that's all about the details and the science. This is not that movie, but it does play with really big themes like God and finding ourselves and coming back from something horrible.
But it's not all there. Like pretty, like it's a story about a relationship between two damaged people, which is a good framework to put it on because that's a story that we all understand. But the shit that surrounds it is so bananas.
It's very symbolic, though. I mean, I do believe that there is thought in every moment, that those things do mean something, and why I find it gratifying afterward is discussing with people, mm-hmm. like, there is a lot to talk about. I don't know if I've seen a movie since, like, The Matrix, where we just talk about arbitrary maybe it's in the film, maybe we're reading too far into it, but it's kind of fun to read too far into it.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, there's been a lot of really good discussions around a lot of movies this year, but that one is definitely the one where you consider, I mean, like, wait, and so then the pig, and then it goes to him in the brown sweater, like, what does that mean? And everyone thinks that actually means
and movie
something.
Nerds love movies like this. But I like what you said about how you liked it better thinking about it than you did when watching it. I felt the same way about Touchy Feely, Lynn Sheldon's movie, which you liked more than most people. And watching it, I was like, this is kind of boring. But then, like, thinking about, like, but I felt like the warmth that she normally has mm-hmm. and, like, the humanity for the characters, who are all, like, really interesting people, like, aside from Ellen Page's awful haircut, which I still won't forgive. But thinking about it later and just the way that the people in the movie interacted with each other and their same sort of thing, like all their broken relationships and how they mend them and stuff like that. Like I found that process of thinking about it to be more interesting than the watching of the movie itself. Mm.
I feel like you maybe get a lot of that for indie movies, Sundance movies, where perhaps the budget wasn't there or because it's such a low budget operation and everyone's has their hands in everything, that there might be a lot of good ideas, but that the execution isn't pulled off mm-hmm. in the right way. Does that mean, in your mind, that they're still good movies? Like, for you, Katie, I feel like Upstream Color might not be a good movie.
Yeah, but I don't know if that means... Like, I think that's doesn't have anything to do with the amount that you think about it. I think it's just what ideas are actually embedded in there, and I don't know if it's... I think it's that it's not a successful movie, not so much not a good movie. I don't know the distinction between them.
I think there's a quality... That there's quality in movies that are new and different and original, like things you see here that have ideas behind them. I think that the biggest failures to me are movies that just tell a really boring story, like, over and over again, like The Way, Way Back, which I mean is, like, a movie you've seen a million times, or Mud, which is a movie you've seen a million times.
Yeah.
Like, all of those movies where it's just kind of, like, retreading. Like, I'd rather see Lynn Shelton fail doing something different than see some stupid male coming-of-age movie
that's
successful. There
have been far fewer of those this year than usual. I mean, I guess there's been a lot of female, like Afternoon Delight, you think.
No, now it's all about, like, older married men.
Right.
Like, breathe in the Doremus movie that is just... It's so Sundance, you know?
Yeah.
It's so like, oh, I'm a musician who didn't make it as a rock star, and now I teach kids, but oh, there's a hot British gal who's an amazing piano player, and she comes and like changes my whole life because I just get so obsessed with her.
Don't ever let a hot woman into your house.
I know.
And over again.
Well, like, I when I wrote about Breathe In, I suggested that we need a new term for Manic Pixie Dream Girl. The evolution of that is now like the smart, rambunctious... doesn't know she's seducing people chick who enters older people's lives. We'll figure it out. That's messy, but yeah, we'll have to come up with a term. It's an emerging trend.
But there's also been a lot of unhappy housewives too. Like
yeah.
that seems to be more of a, like there have been, I've seen a couple of coming of age movies, but yeah, there's a lot of like middle-aged angst.
Well, are they coming from female directors or male directors?
Some of them. Afternoon Delight is from a female director. I guess
yeah.
Breathe In is about Guy Pearce being middle-aged. And
yeah. And then Concussion's from a female director. And what's the other one that I saw?
Well, Touchy Feely is kind of like
Touchy
that.
Touchy Feely is
yeah.
like that
and,
as
I mean,
well.
This year, there are the U.S. dramatic competition is half women directors, which has never happened before.
I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
And I'm really happy I like a lady movie.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of really good lady movies this year. I mean, there's been its fair share of dude movies. It's probably, if you look at it, there's probably more movies with male protagonists than women, because that's just how it works.
But I feel like I've been seeing movies, too, that kind of get away from... I think it is really easy for these low-budget movies, these writer-director movies, to have a voice that's so gender-specific.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I feel like I've seen many movies that defy that. And the two I'm thinking of right off the top of my head, and maybe because I'm currently writing about them, are the Michael Cera Chilean double feature, Crystal Fairy and Magic Magic, which he went to Chile, worked with Sebastian Silva, who directed The Maid, and made these two really different, totally weird movies about just, like, people cruising around Chile, and one is hilarious. Crystal Fairy is all about them wanting to find this mythic cactus, the San
Pedro.
Mythic.
Like, it's a cactus in everyone's
it's real.
Yards, and
okay.
They keep, like, harassing people to be like, can we have your cactus?
It gets you,
like,
it gets
Americans.
You, it's a legendary high.
Yeah.
When you stew it, you'll get really, really high. And it's hilarious, and but also really sweet and touching, and with an amazing performance by Gabby Hoffman,
yeah.
Who, where has she been this whole time? But, like, just
during
a kind of a stunning...
How's the haircut? Is it good?
No, it's pretty nuts. You need to add that to your list, probably.
Yeah, I liked her merkin. but
you
yeah,
it was a Morgan.
That again. I mean, she had some seriously hairy pits too, so
yeah.
It might have been real.
Yeah.
But like, I love that that can just kind of be organic and flow, be really funny, and then kind of hit you out of nowhere with some of Gabby Hoffman stuff. But then they make this movie, Magic Magic, that's like, what, it gave me a fucking panic attack. The movie's psychotic. That's more of a co-starring role for Michael Cera, but it's a bunch of people, Juno Temple, once again, Mr. Skin's favorite, going to an island, like a small island off the coast of Chile, and they go there, and Juno Temple is agoraphobic. She's just scared of everything, and it's so anxiety-ridden. The whole thing's about her being just scared, and Michael Cera making fun of her, like a dog humps her at some point, and Michael Cera's just laughing about that. It is a hard movie to watch. I would recommend, like, stumbling upon it and watching it when it eventually comes out, but like, that movie is about panic attacks, and it will give you a panic attack, and I think that's bold and interesting, and kind of what we were saying before, it's like, is that a good movie?
Right.
Well, it's a successful movie that fucking knocked me out, so.
Yeah.
I had a panic attack watching The Summit, which is a
documentary
about mountain climbing, and it's this expedition on K2 where 11 people died, and they do recreations of, like, people falling off the mountain.
Whoa.
And it's
that's
like, oh my god, I was getting, like, crazy vertigo, and it was one of the first movies I saw, and I was like, I don't think I could make it all the way through this thing. Like, I felt like I was gonna fall off my seat, and here we are in the mountains with these people falling off.
So
oh,
that needs
crazy.
An IMAX release.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my god.
Well,
an IMAX release of that would make me throw up.
So speaking of IMAX releases, I kind of wanted to end by talking about, like, when people are gonna see these. Like, you know, you can find information, but last year we had Beast of the Southern Wild and The Sessions, both, and those seemed like huge breakout hits, and really Beast of the Southern Wild was kind of the only major Sundance hit from last year. Do you guys have a good feeling about anything from this year? It's hard to make predictions about Sundance stuff.
I think Kill Your Darlings will be very successful.
Yeah. Well, it's a small movie, so it doesn't have to have some, like, you know, it doesn't have to make $100 million to be
no,
successful.
No, but I think that Daniel Radcliffe's really good in it, and I think that the people who like him are sort of getting older and might want to see him in a sexier role, and I think it's actually a really good movie, but good in a very accessible, mainstream kind of way that I think audiences and critics will enjoy.
Yeah.
And kind of inverse to that, I feel like Spectacular Now, which has been picked up and will eventually come out somewhere at some point, is the type of movie that can be sold as something conventional and like, oh, the teen romance,
right.
That will end up really challenging people and be critically acclaimed and might be even more successful because of it. Because no Hollywood studio would ever make a movie like Spectacular
Now.
But
it's
so too
good.
Weird.
And I think teenagers would like it if they can get in. It's R-rated, but... You know,
oh, is it?
Yeah,
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, but I do think that movie has a really broad base of appeal. And I'm also, I mean, I haven't seen Fruitvale yet, but and I wish I had, but I'm really intrigued by, like, the Weinstein Company picking it up and, like, the raves that Michael B. Jordan is getting. Like, it seems like the Weinsteins think that's an awards thing, and I'm wondering if that will pan out. And, I mean, you know, Precious happened.
That's
true. I think on the opposite token, though, you see that The Way, Way Back got a huge pickup, and I didn't really like it, and I think it's going to be
easy to sell mm-hmm. because it's got all these stars in it and it's a comedy and it's funny. But I think when people see it, I don't think that people are really going to like it. And I don't know if critics are going to be kind to it or not.
It's very likable. And I do think maybe if some of the hubbub dies down from that giant sale, people will go in with slightly lower expectations. And it's cute and it's got really funny scenes in it. I mean, obviously I think Little Miss Sunshine is the model and it might be able to do Little Miss Sunshine business without having the Oscar stuff, which is fine for a movie like that.
Is there anything that you're worried that, well, I think everything at this point at Sundance gets picked up in some way, but is there anything that you need people to see, like, that might take a little searching that they should definitely watch for?
Oh, interesting.
Because I think everything will come out, you know. The fact that Weinstein now has Radius, which puts tons of movies out on VOD, and just, like, all these different outlets, everything will get picked up, but, you know, sometimes you have to watch. You have to track these movies, and they'll just randomly come out at some point.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff from last year that did that.
Yeah, for me, that's Blue Caprice, which is kind of mixed with most people. I thought it was really disturbing and weird and fascinating character study of the two guys who committed the sniper shootings in Washington, D.C. in 2002, which Brian was around. Washington, D.C. So I don't know if you've seen that yet. But
no, I don't think I want to.
Greatly disturbed. but that's the sort of movie that, like, it's not getting enough buzz, positive buzz, to really play as big as the movie that reminds me of from last year, Compliance, which I think made a big splash, had, like, you know, Q&As where they were giving Craig Zobel the finger and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
so that helped build it up. But Blue Caprice doesn't really have that, so I'm a little worried it's kind of going to get missed when it eventually gets picked up.
I'm having such a hard time thinking of
maybe a documentary.
Yeah, I mean, I was a big fan of After Tiller, which I saw yesterday about the four remaining late-term abortion providers left in the country after George Tiller was murdered a couple of years ago. And it's really humane and this really interesting look at these people and the work that they do and how much they care about their patients. And it's the kind of thing that if you're very staunchly pro-life and you think that they're doing nothing but just, like, killing the babies for lazy people, it really would force you to reconsider that.
Or if you're pro-choice, I mean,
yeah.
I am, and that's documentary is still challenging.
It's really hard to watch, and it's hard for you know that even these doctors who are obviously so firmly supporting these abortion rights are risking their lives for it. It's difficult for them too, and I think it reads like a bummer. People don't want to go see it because it just seems sad, and it is sad, but it's also fascinating and really, I don't know, I found it uplifting in a weird way. So I will hope that, I assume it will be picked up and it will be seen by a small audience, but if you're interested in it and thinking about not going because it sounds too depressing, I would recommend against that and give it a shot.
I would have to go with Pit Stop, which is a movie about homosexuals in Texas falling in love. They live, like, in rural Texas. And for an indie movie, it's, like, good but not great. But for gay movies, it's, like, amazing. Because most gay movies suck. So this will win, like, every gay film festival.
Interesting piece of trivia. Pit Stop, written by the director of another Sundance movie, All Them Body Saints. Ain't Them Body Saints. Who is also the editor of Upstream Color.
Wow, David Lowery's. He's the trend of this year's Sundance.
Yeah, so that's an interesting connection there.
Yeah, and speaking of Ain't Them Body Saints, I think that's another one that I don't know if
it has enough
seem
oomph.
People here seem to be really excited by it, and I think it's a really good, interesting movie, but I don't know that it's going to do.
Yeah,
really
I that's actually a good choice as well. I wasn't thinking about that. I think it's probably time to wrap up.
I think so.
Are you guys happy with your Sundance overall? Brian, this is your first time.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. a lot of time on buses.
Well, you've probably, like, read Sundance coverage before and been aware that it's happening. What is the experience like coming here for the first time?
It's not nearly as glamorous as the coverage makes it seem. Nope. I mean, no parties or gifting
suites. What are you talking about? Cat dance.
Remember we didn't get to go to cat dance.
No, we all got hats.
Annalyn McCord showed off some cat short films.
It's true. And I ate breakfast next to Ed Burns this morning.
Yeah, the amount of bus riding that this requires is so anti-glamorous. And you're sitting there just going in circles around Park City like, what the hell? Like, but the famous people, Annalyn McCord does not ride the bus.
No, Annalyn McCord did not ride the bus. Ed Burns probably isn't riding the bus either. Oh, and I did take a cab with Kyle MacLachlan. So
that's actually pretty sweet.
Who is in
Breathe
In for like one awful scene. So sorry, Kyle.
Well,
I think that about ramps things
up. Yeah, that went on the note of Kyle MacLachlan. Thank you for reading our coverage. If you have been, you can find Patches and Brian's at Hollywood.com. They have a Sundance tag, right?
A hub.
A hub.
I think there's a button to it on Sundance articles.
Mine is on Cinema Blend. It'll be in the slideshow on the front page and all that. And we still got video blogs to post. There's still so much
more Sundance coverage.
There's so much Sundance coverage to see. But yeah, it's been another good year. And
I guess this is the part where we say goodbye.
Oh my god! Yeah, it's the end of the podcast.
This is it.
We do not have your lightning round answers for dessert. And I don't know how to close
Brian,
things out.
Brian, tell them who you are, where they can find you.
Oh, I am Brian Moylan, and I write for Hollywood.com along with Matt Patches. I also write weekly for Vice magazine, mostly about penises, and then I write for The Guardian and various assorted other publications.
And can people follow you on Twitter?
People can follow me on Twitter, at Brian J. Moylan, and they can like my Facebook fan page.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can now suck my own dick because of Brian's Vice articles.
That's true. That's what I like. If you Google how to suck your own dick, I'm the number one Google result.
That is fantastic.
I'm sure your parents are so proud.
Oh my god, I can't even tell you.
And I'm at Patches, Hollywood.com. Follow me on Twitter, Mr. Patches.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we'll be back with our regular programming next week.
Huzzah.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Podcasting.